Hello, I'm Joseph Kassa, and welcome to this podcast where the AI team does a deep dive into some application of systems thinking.
Welcome to our deep dive into systems engineering. I have to say, the material you gave us is really interesting, especially how you're learning all this. Self-paced modules, lectures on demand, exercises, even a whole group discussion thing, but asynchronous.
Yeah, definitely shows a structured approach to learning, and it kind of reflects the adaptability that's often needed in systems engineering itself.
Right. So, okay, we've got readings and exercises and like all sorts of stuff here focused on systems engineering. But right away, I noticed something kind of funny. There's no one definition of what it actually is. It's like, how would you describe an elephant to someone who's never seen one?
That's a great analogy.
Wow.
And that lack of a single definition, it's actually a key insight into how systems engineering works. There's this model, the nine systems model, and it suggests that people approach systems engineering from all these different angles, like the big picture or the operations, the functions, even the number side of things. Each perspective, it's like it has its own blind spots.
So if someone's super focused on the physical system, maybe they miss how that interacts with the social system, right?
Right.
Or the economic side. It's like they're all looking at this elephant, but one's seeing a leg, one's seeing the trunk, you know?
Exactly. And that's where systems thinking comes in. It's about recognizing those blind spots mm-hmm. and trying to integrate all those perspectives mm-hmm. for a more holistic understanding.
Makes total sense. The materials also talk about different kinds of knowledge you need. Declarative, procedural, and then conditional. It made me think about how I learn things. Declarative is just like memorizing facts. Procedural is like following a recipe step by step. But that conditional knowledge, that's where it gets tricky.
Yeah, conditional knowledge is knowing when to use the other stuff and why. It's like being able to adapt to different situations, mm-hmm. understanding the nuances, making judgment calls, you know, based on context.
So on a real project, I might know all the technical stuff, the facts and procedures, but if I don't have that conditional knowledge, I could still mess up big time by applying the wrong solution at the wrong time.
Precisely. And that's where experience comes in and critical thinking and the ability to think in functions, which is really important.
Speaking of which, that thinking in functions idea, that really clicked for me. It's like focusing on what the system needs to do, not jumping to solutions too quickly. So instead of immediately thinking about cables or fiber optics for communication, you first think about the function of communicating itself in a more abstract way.
Perfect example. Thinking in functions, it stops us from getting bogged down in specific technologies too early on. Makes us step back, consider the bigger purpose, all the possible ways to achieve it.
Okay, I'm seeing how this all connects now. Different perspectives, different types of knowledge, and we got to think in functions. But how does this actually play out when you're managing a complex project? I think this system function template you highlighted is a good place to start.
It's a powerful tool. For visualizing and analyzing really any complex project, you break it down into its core elements, input, output, waste, and then the support functions, which are crucial. It helps us see that even things like resource management or just keeping the system itself running, those are vital parts.
You know, I tried using this on my last project and I realized I totally hadn't thought enough about the control function. You know, monitoring progress, making adjustments, keeping everything on track. No wonder I was so overwhelmed.
Yeah, it's a common oversight. And the beauty of the system function template is it's not just for engineering projects. You could use it to plan a vacation, write a paper, even manage your money. It's a way to understand how all the parts are connected, how they contribute to the goal.
Okay, so this is where at first I was like, wait, what does this have to do with systems engineering? But then I got it. It's a perfect example of a hidden system we all use, supply chains.
Ah, yes. Supply chains. They're fascinating. They touch every part of our lives, but we rarely think about the complex systems that get us everything. From coffee to our phones, you know.
Ah.
And the principles of systems engineering, like those support functions we just talked about, they're vital to making them work.
It's true. When I think about those seven rights of a good supply chain, right product, right quantity, right place, right time, and right quality, customer, and price, seems almost impossible to get all that right consistently.
It is incredibly challenging, especially with all the different players involved, suppliers, manufacturers, distributors, retailers, all working in a very dynamic and often unpredictable environment. That's where things like lean manufacturing and Six Sigma come in.
I always thought of those as just buzzwords, but now I see how they're directly related to systems thinking. It's all about optimizing the whole system, reducing waste, minimizing variation, and ultimately delivering a better product to the customer.
Exactly. And what's often overlooked is the human element. These methodologies, they involve changing behaviors, improving communication, empowering employees to, you know, identify and solve problems themselves.
Okay, and this is where I started getting nervous. Supply chain risks, financial risks, reputational risks, those aren't just theoretical, are they?
Oh, they're very real. And they can have a cascading effect. Imagine a single component shortage causes production delays that leads to lost revenue, frustrated customers, could even damage a company's whole brand.
It's like dominoes, right? One weak link can trigger a chain reaction, which brings us to the systems engineering life cycle, where we see how all these concepts come together in the process of, you know, designing and building a system. And apparently there are different paradigms for how that happens.
The A versus B paradigms, they represent two distinct approaches. A is more traditional. You start with the clear vision, and then you derive requirements from that vision.
Yeah.
B is more common now, though. You start by gathering requirements and then develop the concept of operations, or CONA PS.
So A is like building a house from a blueprint. B is figuring out what kind of house you need based on like how you want to live in it. But why is B more common these days?
It reflects the world we live in now. Yeah. You know, things are complex. They change fast. The initial problem might be less clearly defined. You might have lots of stakeholders with different, maybe even conflicting needs. B allows for more flexibility, iteration, adaptation along the way.
Okay, so we need to be adaptable, but we also need some kind of framework to guide us. That's where the egg model comes in, right? I gotta admit, when I first saw that, I pictured a literal egg.
It's a great visual, though, isn't it? The egg model, it represents the life cycle as these interconnected states.
Right.
From identifying needs all the way to operations and maintenance. But the key is, it's not a simple linear process.
So it's not like cracking an egg, that's it. It's more like those Russian nesting dolls. Each stage contains smaller versions of itself. It's a recursive.
Exactly. You might have to loop back to earlier stages as you get new information or requirements change, or you run into unexpected challenges.
Which makes those milestone reviews so important, right, at each stage, like the systems requirements review or the preliminary design review. But I'm sensing there's more to those reviews than just checking boxes on a checklist.
Oh, absolutely. These reviews are key points where all the stakeholders get together, evaluate progress,
yeah,
make decisions, address any potential issues, and yes, there's definitely a big human element involved. These reviews can be pretty intense.
I bet. You've got different personalities, everyone's got their priorities, and there's probably a lot of pressure to stay on schedule and, you know, within budget. It's like a microcosm of the whole systems engineering process itself.
You got it. And that brings us to what might seem like the most boring part.
Yeah.
But it's actually the most crucial requirements.
I know. Requirements don't sound very exciting. But your sources made it clear bad requirements can doom even the best engineering team. It's like trying to bake a cake without a recipe, right?
And the problem isn't just bad requirements. It's the lack of clarity, unspoken assumptions, conflicting expectations. A requirement that seems crystal clear to one person might be totally ambiguous to someone else.
Okay, this is where I had one of those aha moments. The source material talks about those five types of systems engineers: innovators, problem formulators, problem solvers, translators, and integrators. And I thought, which one am I? And which ones are missing on my team?
That's a great question to ask. And you know what separates a good systems engineer from a truly outstanding one? It's often the ability to not just take requirements at face value, but to really understand what the needs and goals are underneath.
Like being a detective, right? Uncovering clues, putting the whole story together, making sure you're solving the right problem in the first place.
You're exactly right. And one of the best examples of what happens when requirements go wrong is that Pentagon Wars case study, a real cautionary tale, mm-hmm. shows what happens when there's miscommunication, conflicting priorities, and a failure to truly understand the user's needs.
Yeah, that case study was wild. So much money wasted, time wasted, all because the requirements were like poorly defined and kept changing, really makes you realize how high the stakes can be.
It does. And it underscores the importance of communication, collaboration, and never losing sight of the user. Which brings us to the next stage, integration and testing. This is where the rubber meets the road, where all those requirements and design choices are put to the test.
And this is where it gets really interesting, I think. It's not just about making sure each part works on its own. It's about how they all work together as a system. And that's when those emergent properties, the good and the bad, can show up, right?
Absolutely. It's like they say, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. You can have a system where each component is perfect in isolation, but when you put them together, bam, unexpected behaviors, problems you never saw coming.
Like that story from the source material about the astronaut on the moon who accidentally breaks a critical cable. Talk about high stakes, limited resources, the need for creative solutions really brings home the challenges of integration.
It's a great example. Even the most carefully planned systems, they can run into unforeseen problems, especially when you throw human factors into the mix.
Okay, so we need to be ready for those unknown unknowns, but we also need a way to manage the stuff we do know about. That's where configuration management comes in, right? I gotta admit, this part seemed kind of boring at first.
Configuration management may not be glamorous, but it's essential. It's how you maintain control, keep things organized as a system evolves and changes.
I'm picturing like this giant spreadsheet tracking every single component, every little tweak, every software update. Is that what it's all about?
It can involve spreadsheets.
Yeah.
But it's bigger than that. It's about having a system for documenting, tracking changes, making sure different versions are compatible, and being able to, you know, go back to older versions if you need to.
So it's like a history of the system, a way to trace back every decision, every modification, a safety net in case something goes wrong. Makes sense, especially for really complex systems that could be running for years or even decades.
Right. And it's not just about the physical parts. Configuration management also includes the documentation, the software, even the processes you use to develop and maintain the system.
So it's about keeping track of the whole ecosystem of the system. That's a lot to manage.
It is. And that's why effective configuration management relies on good tools,
yeah,
good processes, and a culture of, well, discipline and attention to detail.
Okay, so our configuration's under control. Time for the final test. Developmental testing versus operational testing, what's the difference?
Well, developmental testing, or DT&E, it's about verifying that the system meets all those specified requirements. It's often done in a controlled environment by the developers themselves. Operational testing, OT&E, that's about evaluating how it performs in the real world, under real conditions.
So DT&E is like testing a car on a track. OT&E is taking it out on the open road with real drivers, traffic, weather, all that. I'm guessing OT&E is where things can get really interesting, right?
Absolutely. OT&E is where you really put the system through its paces and where those unforeseen challenges, those emergent properties, they can really show up.
It's the ultimate test to see if the system is truly fit for its purpose, if it can really meet the needs of the user out there in the real world.
Exactly. And that's a key takeaway from this first part of our deep dive.
Yeah.
Systems engineering is about so much more than just technical skills. It's about understanding the context, the users, the long-term implications, and the need to constantly adapt and improve.
I'm definitely starting to see the bigger picture now, from those different perspectives to the importance of requirements, integration, testing. You've given us a lot to think about.
I'm glad to hear that. And in the next part of our deep dive, we're going to dig even deeper into systems engineering, explore some specific techniques, challenges, and real-world examples.
Sounds great. I'm ready for even more insights and practical advice to help us apply systems thinking to the challenges we face every day.
Until then, keep those systems running smoothly.
Welcome back. I feel like in part one, we really unpacked those foundational ideas of systems engineering, the different perspectives, the types of knowledge you need, that whole think and functions thing. It's like we built the groundwork for how complex systems actually work.
Right. And now we can build on that foundation, explore the more practical side, how you actually do systems engineering. And maybe a good place to start is revisiting those requirements. They're not just a checklist. They're like the blueprint for the whole system.
Yeah, and we saw what happens when those blueprints are messed up. That Pentagon Wars case study, yikes. It seems like getting those requirements right, it's more about communication and collaboration than just like the technical specs.
Absolutely. A systems engineer has to be a bit of a translator, you know, bridging the gap between what the customer thinks they want and what they actually need. That means asking the right questions, digging deeper, sometimes even challenging assumptions.
So a really good systems engineer wouldn't just take a vague requirement like user-friendly. They'd push back and say, okay, but what specific tasks will users be doing? What would make those tasks easier? How can we even measure user-friendliness?
Exactly. It's about turning those fuzzy ideas into concrete, measurable criteria, which leads us to verification and validation, two very important concepts.
Okay, I'll admit I mix those up sometimes. Verification is like checking your work as you go along, making sure you're building the system right according to the specs. Validation is more about making sure you're building the right system, the one that actually solves the problem you're trying to solve.
perfect. And those processes, they run through the entire life cycle. From the early design reviews to all those tests you do, you're constantly verifying and validating to make sure the system is both technically sound and operationally effective.
You know, there was this great analogy in the material about a ship's navigation system. You could verify that all the components are working perfectly, but if the map data is outdated, the whole system is useless, right? That's validation, making sure it's the right system for the job.
Love that analogy. Really highlights why we can't just focus on the technical stuff. We got to consider the big picture, what the user needs, the whole purpose of the system.
And then on top of all that, there's independent verification and validation, or IVNV. Why is it so important to bring in a third party like that?
Objectivity. Hmm. A fresh pair of eyes, they can often spot risks or problems that the development team might have missed, especially when you've got these complex systems with so many moving parts.
Like having an auditor come in, check the books, right? Make sure everything's on the up and up, no hidden surprises.
Precisely. IVNV gives you that extra layer of assurance that the system is, well, truly ready to go.
Right.
But then, how do systems engineers actually manage all this complexity? The source material talked about having a toolbox of techniques and approaches.
Right. And I'm curious, what's in that toolbox? Is it all fancy software algorithms, or are there more like old school methods too?
It's a mix. Systems engineers definitely use sophisticated software, modeling and simulation to predict how systems will behave. But they also rely on, more traditional techniques, functional analysis, trade studies, risk assessment matrices, things like that.
So it's like having a high-tech lab and a well-equipped workshop. You choose the right tool for the job.
Exactly. And it's not just about the tools themselves. It's knowing how to use them effectively. A good systems engineer understands the strengths and limitations of each tool and when to use which one.
Okay, so we've got our requirements, our verification and validation processes, our toolbox. But what about the human element? The source material talked about all these challenges that systems engineers face, and a lot of them seem to come from, like, communication breakdowns or not really understanding the user's needs.
Very true. One of the biggest challenges is managing complexity. Not just the technical complexity of the system, but the complexity of the teams, the stakeholders, the whole environment the system will be operating in.
So it's not just bits and bytes. It's people, processes, even politics, right? And that takes a whole different skill set. Communication, negotiation, conflict resolution.
Exactly. A systems engineer needs to be a diplomat, a translator, a mediator, all in one. They need to be able to communicate with technical experts, managers, end users, everybody.
It's like conducting an orchestra, bringing all those different instruments together to make music. And one instrument that's often overlooked is the user themselves. The human factors stuff really stood out to me in the source material.
All human factors are absolutely critical. It's all about understanding how people interact with technology, designing systems that are intuitive, easy to use, considering the cognitive and physical limitations of human operators.
It makes me realize how often we design systems that are technically amazing, but then totally unusable in the real world, like having a supercomputer with a keyboard that's impossible to type on.
Perfect analogy. And that's why human factors engineers are so important. They bring that user-centered perspective to the design process. They are the ones advocating for usability, accessibility, safety.
Okay, I'm seeing how these pieces fit together now. The technical skills, the communication and collaboration, the awareness of human factors. But what about the overall process? We talked about the systems engineering lifecycle in part one with that egg model, but let's break down those stages a bit more.
Sure. The lifecycle usually involves several key stages: needs identification, requirements analysis, design synthesis, implementation, integration, testing, deployment, and then operations and maintenance. And remember, it's not linear. It's iterative, recursive. You're constantly looping back, refining, adapting.
More like a dance than a march, right?
Yeah.
You're always adjusting your steps, responding to your partner, improvising as you go along.
Love that. And each stage of the dance has its own unique challenges, its own things to consider.
Let's take a closer look at each one. We already talked about needs and requirements, but what about design synthesis? Is that where the engineers really get to be creative, come up with those innovative solutions?
Design synthesis is where those abstract requirements get translated into actual design decisions. It's a very iterative process. Brainstorming, trade studies, modeling, and simulation. Lots of back and forth between different disciplines.
It's like having a giant jigsaw puzzle, right?
Yeah.
Trying to figure out how all the pieces fit together. And sometimes you realize, oh, I need a different piece, or I need to reshape this one to make it fit.
Exactly. And those missing pieces are the ones that don't quite fit. Those often represent those emergent properties we talked about. You might have designed each part perfectly, but then you put them together and, well, things happen that you didn't expect.
Like they say, no plan survives contact with the enemy. You got to be ready to adapt, improvise, make those tough decisions on the fly.
And that's where experience comes in, intuition, and that systems thinking mindset. It's about being able to see the big picture, anticipate problems, and find those creative solutions that address the root cause, not just the symptoms.
Okay, design is synthesized, now I gotta make it real. That's implementation, right? The source material called it the hands-on phase. All the coding, building, putting it all together.
Exactly. Implementation is where those design blueprints become reality. Software gets written, hardware gets built, all the components get assembled and integrated.
It's like the construction phase, when you see those architectural drawings turning into, well, bricks and mortar. And I'm guessing this stage has its own set of challenges, right? Things that can go wrong.
Absolutely. Implementation is often where you uncover those unforeseen technical challenges. You might have components that aren't compatible, manufacturing defects, integration problems that you didn't see in the design phase.
It's where those emergent properties can really sneak up on you, right?
A
component might work fine by itself, but then you connect it to the system and suddenly weird stuff starts happening.
Exactly. Which is why communication and collaboration are so important during this stage. You need good coordination between the teams, clear documentation, and a willingness to, adapt and solve problems as they come up.
Okay, we've implemented it. Now it's time to put it all together. Integration. Like taking all those pieces of furniture and making a living room, right?
Great analogy.
Yeah.
Integration is all about bringing those separate components together and making sure they work together seamlessly as one unified system.
And I bet that can be tricky, especially with complex systems, hundreds, thousands of parts.
You're right. Integration often means dealing with compatibility issues, resolving conflicts between subsystems, making sure the interfaces are working properly. It's a very iterative process. Lots of testing, debugging, fine-tuning.
It's like trying to make all those puzzle pieces fit perfectly. And sometimes you realize you need a totally different piece. So what are some things to keep in mind during integration? What should systems engineers be focusing on?
A clear integration plan is key. This outlines the order you'll integrate components in, the tests you'll use, the criteria for success. It's like a roadmap for the whole process.
Yeah.
Keeps everyone on the same page, helps you spot problems early.
Makes sense. Like a checklist for assembling that complicated furniture. Make sure you don't have extra screws or parts that don't line up.
Exactly. And it's not just the physical components. It's the software, too, the data. All the different interfaces between the parts of the system.
It's about creating that seamless experience for the user, making sure it all works together smoothly.
You got it. And integration is where those emergent properties, the ones we keep talking about, can really show up. Mm-hmm. You might have two subsystems that work perfectly fine separately, but then you connect them and bam, they start acting weird. Or you realize the user interface is confusing.
So it's like integration is where those unknown unknowns become known unknowns, as you start seeing how the whole system behaves. Which brings us to testing. We already talked about the different types, developmental, operational, that independent verification and validation. But what are some important things to keep in mind during the testing phase?
Testing is all about making sure the system is working correctly, that it meets the requirements, and that it's ready to be deployed. Like we discussed, there are different levels of testing, from component testing to system testing, and then operational testing. Each level has its own goals, its own procedures, its own criteria for success.
So it's like a series of exams, starting with individual quizzes and then the big final at the end. And I bet testing can reveal a whole bunch of problems that you didn't see before, right?
You're absolutely right. Testing often uncovers those hidden bugs, design flaws, unexpected interactions between different parts. It's crucial for finding and fixing those issues before the system goes out to real users.
It's like the dress rehearsal before a play opens, right? Make sure everything runs smoothly, the audience will have a good experience. Speaking of experience, let's talk about deployment. This is when the system goes live out into the real world.
Right. Deployment is the culmination of the whole process. This is when the system goes into operation and starts delivering those benefits to the user, the customer. It's exciting, but it takes a lot of careful planning and coordination.
Yeah.
And you often need to monitor and adjust things even after it's deployed.
So you don't just flip a switch and walk away. There's a lot involved in making sure it goes smoothly, that the system integrates well into the user's environment.
Exactly. Deployment often includes things like training users, configuring the system, setting up procedures for maintenance and support. It's about making sure the system isn't just technically good, but also operationally effective and sustainable.
And I'm guessing even after deployment, the systems engineer's job isn't done. There's probably a lot to monitor, evaluate, maybe even tweak as the system gets used in the real world.
Absolutely. Deployment is usually followed by operations and maintenance. You monitor how the system is performing, fix any issues, and make updates or modifications as needed. And as we've been saying all along, systems engineering is iterative. It never really stops. Even after deployment, you might need to revisit the requirements, tweak the design, keep improving things over time. It's all about making sure the system keeps meeting its purpose, adapts to changing needs, and delivers value throughout its whole life cycle.
Like a garden, right? It needs constant care, watering, pruning to keep thriving. And I'm seeing another theme here. Systems engineering isn't just about building things. It's about understanding the context, the users, thinking long term, and always being ready to adapt and improve.
That's a great observation. Effective systems engineering, it's a holistic process, and it's iterative. It involves a deep understanding of the system, its environment, how it interacts with the world. It's about creating systems that are technically sound and operationally effective, user-friendly, and sustainable for the long haul. And as technology keeps advancing and the systems we build get even more complex, these principles are becoming more and more crucial.
That's a great point to wrap up part two on. We've gone deep into requirements, verification, and validation, and all the stages of that systems engineering lifecycle, from design to deployment and beyond. You've given us a much better understanding of what it takes to do systems engineering. And I'm already starting to see how these principles could be applied to all sorts of things, not just engineering.
I'm glad to hear that. And remember, systems thinking, it's not just for engineers. The ideas we've talked about, like thinking in functions, understanding the lifecycle, anticipating those emergent properties, those are valuable tools for anyone dealing with complex problems, in business, in their personal life, even just trying to understand the world around them.
That's a great takeaway. We'll be back in part three with even more insights and practical advice for using systems thinking to tackle the challenges you face. Until then, keep those systems running smoothly. Welcome back to our final part. We've covered so much ground, from those core concepts of systems engineering all the way to the real world stuff, the life cycle, the challenges. Now I'm thinking, what does this all mean for our listeners? How can they use systems thinking in their own lives?
Yeah, that's the big question, right? And I think the first thing to realize is systems thinking isn't just for engineers. It's a skill that can help anyone who's facing any kind of complex challenge, whether it's at work, in their personal life, even just trying to understand the world.
It makes me think back to that nine systems model we talked about, those different perspectives on a system, and how in the real world, those viewpoints can totally clash sometimes. Imagine a team designing like a new transportation system. You've got engineers focused on efficiency, city planners thinking about accessibility, politicians worried about costs, and then residents, they're worried about noise.
It's going to be a mess if they don't communicate, if they don't find a way to integrate those perspectives. The systems engineer in that situation, they have to be like a master facilitator, helping everyone see the big picture, understand each other's priorities, and come up with solutions that, work for everybody.
So it's not enough to just have the technical skills. You got to be good at communication, collaboration, finding that balance between all those different systems, which reminds me, we got to talk about the human element again.
Oh, yeah. Human factors. That's often what makes or breaks a system. You could have the most brilliant technical solution in the world, but if it's too hard to use, or it's unsafe, or it just doesn't work the way people actually behave, well, it's not going to be a success.
Classic example, the Norman door. You know, those doors that are so poorly designed, you can never tell if you should push or pull. It's like the perfect example of how ignoring human factors can lead to frustration, waste of time, even accidents.
Yeah, and it's not just about usability either.
Yeah.
Human factors, it also includes things like cognitive workload, stress, how people make decisions under pressure, even cultural factors that can affect how people use technology.
Makes me think about self-driving cars. It's not just about the technology itself. It's about how people perceive those cars. Do they trust them? How do they behave around them? What happens in different traffic situations?
Exactly. Understanding human factors is crucial if you want to design systems that are, well, not just functional, but also safe, reliable, and actually good for society.
Okay, so we've talked about those different perspectives, the need for good communication, and how important those human factors are. But let's get back to systems thinking itself. What are some concrete ways people can use this kind of thinking in their everyday lives?
One of the most powerful things a systems thinker can do is map things out, identify the key elements of a system, see how they're connected, understand how changes in one part can affect everything else.
So it's like creating a mental model, right? To help you visualize those relationships, those feedback loops. Can you give us an example, like how someone could actually use this?
Sure. Imagine you're trying to, say, improve your team's productivity at work. A systems thinker wouldn't just focus on individual tasks or deadlines. They'd look at the whole context, the communication channels, how decisions are made, what the incentives are, even the physical workspace.
So they'd map out this team productivity system, see all those interconnected factors, and then look for those leverage points, where even a small change could make a big difference to the whole system.
Exactly. And they'd think about the unintended consequences, too. Like, maybe you implement a new time tracking software. Could improve accountability, but it also might increase stress or stifle creativity if it feels too controlling.
It's about thinking holistically, right? Seeing those ripple effects. Finding solutions that address the root cause, not just the symptoms.
Right. And it's not just about fixing problems, either. Systems thinking can also be a powerful tool for innovation for design. When you understand how a system works, you can see opportunities to make it better, create new connections, even redesign the whole system to achieve what you want.
So it's not just about fixing what's broken. It's about seeing the potential, what it could be. I like that.
Exactly. And remember, systems thinking isn't one size fits all. There are lots of tools and techniques that systems engineers use, and they choose the best ones for the specific situation.
Right, that toolbox we talked about, the modeling software, the risk matrices, all those techniques. But it seems like the most important tool is that systems mindset itself, that ability to see the world as this web of interconnected systems.
Couldn't have said it better myself. It's about being curious, being willing to look beyond the obvious, understanding that everything's connected in some way.
And it's not just about these big, complex technical systems either. You can apply systems thinking to your personal finances, your health, your relationships.
It's a way to approach the world, you know, more holistically, with more nuance, recognizing that there are usually multiple causes and effects, feedback loops, unintended consequences.
It's becoming clear to me that systems thinking is more than just a set of tools. It's a way of being. It's about noticing patterns, embracing complexity, understanding that we're all part of these systems, whether we realize it or not.
I love that. And as the world gets more complex, more interconnected, that systems mindset is only going to become more important. It's about finding solutions that aren't just technically good, but also socially responsible, environmentally sustainable, ultimately good for humanity.
That's a really inspiring thought to wrap up on. We've covered so much in this deep dive, the basics of systems engineering, the practical applications of systems thinking. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and insights with us.
My pleasure. And remember, systems thinking, it's a journey. Keep exploring, keep asking questions, keep looking for those connections.
And to everyone listening, thank you for joining us on this journey. We hope you've learned some valuable things, found some useful tools to help you with those complex challenges you face. Until next time, keep those systems running smoothly.
I hope you enjoyed today's deep dive. Why not take a moment and join the discussion in the LinkedIn group, Tackling Complex Problems? Take care.